Welcome back to The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman, and this morning for Catherine Cruz. So much of the story of Hawaii is made up of stories of immigration. Many threads make up the fabric of our current communities, one of them from the Philippines. And tomorrow is Cicada Day, honoring the early waves of Filipino laborers who came to work harvesting sugar on the plantations across the state. The first arrivals landed in Honolulu on December 20th, 1906, aboard the SS Doric. Cicada is a Filipino word for the workers recruited by the Hawaii Sugar Planters Association from 1906 to 1946. This past weekend on the Big Island, the Hamakua community honored the last surviving cicadas. Let's take a listen.
My tide, my luna, my ye. Apolakai, moms, dads, maraming salamat. Our kuleana is to instill and practice these values of determination, foresight, and that's because it's our job. So let's all enjoy today and every day. Enjoy who you have or who you had, and there are not very many left. In 2006, we had a whole row of 25. Today we have 7. So celebrate with gusto, and please, please, Apulakit, Apulakai, you are our roots, and we thank you for all that you have done. So how about a nice round of applause for all of our suppliers and their offspring.
That was Sandra Claveria, the Big Island Cicada Singers, singing the Cicada song, and Lorraine Mendoza, co-chair of the Cicada Day 2018 Event Committee at last Sunday's commemorative festivities. HPR's Catherine Cruz spoke with Norman Arancon, a University of Hawaii professor, about the events that were organized to honor the surviving sugar workers, acknowledging their contributions to their Big Island community.
The main event is to honor the 9 living cicadas on the Big Island. They are all in their 90s, and we're honoring them because I think that April 9, 2015, Governor David Iges signed the House Bill 604, which is the celebration of the Cicada Day. So we designate every December 20th of each year a Cicada Day. So the House Bill 604 is called Relating to Cicada Day.
Tell us about the 9 survivors.
Well, the 9 survivors basically are the ones that are remaining here on the Big Island. They're part of those that came here on the third wave of Filipinos that were contracted to work for the sugarcane plantation. The first 15 arrived here in 1906, and then these the remaining ones arrived in 1946.
And so tell us about the jobs that these surviving 9 had.
Yeah, so when they were hired to work here in Hawaii, they were hired to do plantation, they do labor in the sugarcane plantations, and they are mostly assigned in, Honoka'a area. They work in a plantation with their family, so some of them left on their own, and some of them left their families behind. Right now, since the plantation was closed in 1985, I guess it was, they're living with their families as retired people and enjoying, their lives together with a family.
So who were the 9? Can you share with us?
Yeah, sure. One is Pedro Dominguez. He migrated from Ilocos Norte at the age of 24. The second one is Benigno Gebeng Lagat. He's from Ilocos Norte as well, and is married to Regarda Soling Toribio. And they were able to raise 9 children since living here in Hawaii. He's now 95. We also have another 95 years old, also from Ilocos Norte, Filimon Lorenzo. And then we have Ramon Paho, He was 19 when he migrated from Vigan, Ilocosur. He was married to Virgie Cabado and raised three boys. The next one is Agaton Pasalo. He was from Ilocos Norte at the age of 22, and he worked at the Olaa Sugar Mill, Honomo Sugar Mill, and retired from Puna Sugar Company as a crane operator. Now he's 94. We have a 97-year-old Sakada, Marcelino Kirubin. He is from Ilocos Sur, and he was a sugarcane cutter at Pipiqueo Sugar Company. We also have Rafael Quaresma Taruma. Taruma is a Pipiqueo resident and originally from Tawai, Ilocos Norte. He started off as a sugarcane cutter and fertilizer applicator, but eventually worked his way up to a cane truck driver for the Pipiqueo Sugar Company. He is 95 years old. The other one is Fabian Toribio. Toribio is from Kapaau, Kohala, originally from Lawag City, Ilocos Norte. He was assigned to Kohala Sugar Company as a Hana fertilizer man, and then he was assigned as a painter, too. So all of these Sakadas will be honored. So we try to pay respects to our Sakadas who really paved the way of a lot of our lives, you know, the next generation that came to Hawaii. They were the ones, because they also were very involved in labor demonstrations when they were in the plantation. So
that's right, because there were some pretty amazing strikes when you look back at our labor history.
Correct.
And these were our contract laborers. These are the folks whose children also then worked on a lot of these plantations.
That's right. They contribute so much to the economy then, and now since they really make way for the next generation of Filipinos. So just, you know, do not just work in the plantations, but now they are in other fields. So we enjoy, you know, the freedom of working in other fields, like the health area being. We now have a new wave of Filipino migrants. We call the whole thing now diaspora of Filipinos. So we try now to connect. We're connecting our past and to reshape our future. So they are our past that now is shaping our future by welcoming all the other Filipino migrants that work in other fields like education. Like I came here not knowing what the Sakada endured, and now I enjoy the freedom of teaching in a university where you know, most Filipinos couldn't even do before. So and a lot of Filipinos enjoyed doing other stuff in the field of arts and sciences and nursing and all other fields. And we owe a lot of this freedom and a lot of these fields that we excel in to our Sakadas.
And because you're a professor of horticulture, what can you tell us about the folks working the farms along that coast, Hamakua and Hilo?
Yeah, so I'm currently involved with people who are, you know, descendants from the Sakadas working in the plantations. Now the papaya, they're papaya. Some of them are papaya growers. Some of them grow other crops like ginger and sweet potato. So these livelihood right now in the Hamakua coast, actually some of them were, you know, second, third generation Sakadas, of the Sakadas that are now involved in the growing of papayas in Puna area and sweet potato in the Hamakua coast area. So some of them still have, you know, this vivid memories of how they were in the plantations before, but with a different set of problems because they are involved in a different crop. But with the recent, you know, there's the recent volcanic eruption kind of displaced them again. And these are the things that we're trying to help them maybe divert their lives into something else. Mm-hmm. Because, like, right now we're trying to see whether they can find another place to grow papaya, for example, or maybe divert their divert their crops into something else, because we have had few research before that the Hamakua Coast is not suitable for papaya for a lot of reasons, soil type and climatic conditions and all that. So we're trying here at UH Hilo, we're trying to assist farmers to continue their livelihood despite the fact that some of our larger areas that grows papaya have been wiped out by the recent lava flows.
Right, finding a way for the future.
Correct.
That was Catherine Cruz talking with UH Hilo Professor Norman Arancon, who also co-chaired this year's Cicada Day event in Hamakua. Just 3 years ago, the Governor David Ige proclaimed December 20th Cicada Day. Ige's family has roots in plantation life. The governor himself used to work at the Dole Pineapple Cannery. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Born in Honolulu in 1894, Robert Alexander Anderson, a composer who wrote a number of popular Hawaiian songs in the hapa-haole genre, including Lovely Hula Hands in 1940. Though Anderson had no formal training in music, did not speak any Hawaiian, his compositions came to be highly regarded both in and outside of Hawaii. Outside of music, Robert Alexander Anderson, also known for his service during World War I, which included being taken as a prisoner of war by the Germans and planning a successful escape, an inspiration for the 1938 film The Dawn Patrol. But above all else, Anderson is most often remembered for composing one of Hawaii's most famous Christmas tunes in 1949. For today's Backyard Quiz, we want you to name that tune. Call 941-3689. Or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tony Lim, CPA, specializing in trust and estate taxation, accounting, and administration. Learn more at tlimcpa.com.
Here's a sort of a seasonal quiz about presents, economics, and laws. Suppose you're in California, wanted to ship holiday gifts to friends in Hawaii and in Australia. Which shipment do you think would cost more? The trip to Australia is much longer, but unless you're using next-day air delivery, it's also probably cheaper. The reason is a 100-year-old shipping law known as the Jones Act. A recent conference in Washington, D.C. explored the law's impacts on Hawaii and other parts of the United States that are separated from the mainland. HBR's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
In the age of Amazon, many consumers have come to expect free shipping. But if you live in Hawaii, you're paying for shipping whether you have Prime or not. Around 80% of goods on Hawaii's shelves come from somewhere else, and most of them came here on a ship. Ships arriving from a foreign port have to clear U.S. customs upon arrival, but ships coming from elsewhere in the U.S. also have rules. Those rules come from a 1920 law commonly known as the Jones Act. That was the topic of a recent symposium hosted by the Libertarian Cato Institute, which describes itself as dedicated to the principles of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Michael Hansen is with the Hawaii Shippers Council and attended that conference.
The Jones Act is, in its most narrow definition, is Section 27 of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. And that section of the law requires for that a vessel be U.S.-built, U.S.-flagged, U.S.-owned, and U.S.-crewed in order to carry cargo from one domestic point to another.
So if your Amazon package came on a ship from a warehouse on the U.S. mainland, it's required to come on a ship built in the United States, owned and operated by an American company, and crewed by American citizens or residents. That drives up the cost of shipping.
the main cost driver is the cost of the ships themselves. Typically, when you talk about your large seagoing ships, say a container ship or a tanker, the kind of ship that would come from the U.S. mainland to Hawaii with cargo, those vessels will cost, built in the U.S., about five times what they cost in, say, South Korea. The Asian countries of Japan, South Korea, and China build over 90% of the world's seagoing ships today.
So why do ships made in the USA cost more than foreign imports? Unlike other manufacturing industries, the answer isn't cheap labor.
They build in series production. They have the economy of scale that allows them to reduce the cost of each ship.
Economy of scale means that the more you make of something, the more efficient you can be in production, lowering the overall cost. More expensive ships mean that American shipping companies need to charge more on domestic routes to cover those costs. This hits certain places more than others.
The cost of domestic shipping in the United States puts a burden on not only Hawaii, but Alaska, Guam, and Puerto Rico. There's a number of ways the costs are increased. One is that because the ships are so expensive to build in the United States, you have an artificial shortage of ships. We don't have all the kinds of vessels that would be available in the world fleet, for example. And the capital cost of the ship is much higher. So this has to be amortized and included in the freight rate that they're charging whoever the cargo owner is shipping the cargo from the West Coast to here.
If you live on one of the neighbor islands, there is almost no avoiding this Jones Act surcharge. That's because everything coming into Hawaii via ship first makes a stop at the port of Honolulu, an American city. That means that your new mattress coming from China will be transferred to a more expensive Jones Act compliant ship for its trip to Kahului, Kauai High, or Niuliuli. Products coming from the U.S. mainland get hit twice. That impacts Hawaii consumers, but it especially impacts Hawaii-based manufacturers. Bob Gunter is the president and CEO of the Kaloa Rum Company. Kaloa Rum was featured at the Cato Conference in Washington.
Kaloa Rum Company was founded in 2006. We began bottling rum here on the island of Kauai in September of 2009. We currently distribute our products in 25 states within the United States and also in Canada, Japan, and New Zealand. Our primary distillery is located in Kalaheo on Kauai, where all of our distilling, blending, bottling, and packaging is done. The rum that we make is made with Hawaiian cane sugar. We purchased 190 tons of raw sugar from HCNS in Maui from their last harvest a year and a half ago, and we currently are drawing down on that supply now. We have approximately 2 years' supply of that sugar remaining on hand. We are supplementing that with cane now that we are growing here on Kauai. We're expanding our cane cultivation efforts and hope to eventually have upwards of 100 to 150 acres of cane in the ground within the next several years.
Although Kaloa Rum doesn't need to import its main ingredient, it does need to bring in a lot of other items.
We do import most of our input supplies and some of our other ingredients. For example, glass bottles. There are no glass bottles produced in Hawaii, so all of the rum that we bottle in all sizes, those bottles have to be imported from the mainland U.S. We also import and ship in by ocean freight caps, corrugated cartons for the cases, and other ingredients and supplies.
And all of that has to come in on a Jones Act ship. But Gunter's company also gets hit on the back end. Kaloa brand rum has to be shipped to Honolulu for distribution to the U.S. mainland and foreign markets.
Just to give you an example, we shipped a container load of rum to Australia several years ago, and we were not able to ship directly because there's no service between Hawaii and Australia. The only option was to ship first to the West Coast, and the freight cost for that container going to Los Angeles was approximately $5,900. And then the rate from Los Angeles to Sydney was approximately $1,900. So obviously the distance, the geographical distance between California and Sydney is greater than between Hawaii and California. And there was an obvious wide disparity in the cost. So we look at that as an example of the impact, the disparate impact that the Jones Act has on us here in Hawaii, because it results in what seems to be exorbitant freight rates.
Michael Hansen from the Shippers Council said the options to reach foreign ports from Hawaii have improved in recent years.
We have a direct weekly service from Asian ports to Hawaii, which is a pretty good service. It's operated by Ocean Network Express, otherwise known as One. And we have a service from Australia, New Zealand, and Fiji to Hawaii that operates on an every two-monthly basis, but provided by Hapag-Lloyd. It's a German company. And they proceed from Hawaii to the U.S. West Coast and then back around to Australia. And that service, they bring a good deal of the imports that we see from Australia and New Zealand land with that particular service. And it's also possible to ship from Hawaii to Australia or New Zealand using that same service on what are known as foreign flag freight rates.
Most economists agree that the Jones Act is the type of protectionist measure that helps a particular interest group at the expense of everyone else. In this case, it's the U.S. domestic shipbuilding and shipping industries that benefit, and we're unlikely to see a change in the law anytime soon.
I have spoken with some of our congressional delegations, or at least the staff, in Washington, D.C. The reaction was essentially that there was no interest in taking on this issue on behalf of Hawaii, that is, recommending any changes to the status quo.
The members of Hawaii's congressional delegation have historically opposed any changes to the Jones Act. Senators Brian Schatz and Mazie Hirono have both expressed opposition to repealing or modifying the law, as has Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. They have argued that maintaining a domestic shipbuilding industry is a national security imperative, and that changes to the Jones Act could impact hundreds of thousands of jobs around the country. During the 2018 campaign, the delegation's newest member, Congressman-elect Ed Case, expressed support for some kind of update to the 98-year-old law. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
If you want to check out more of the substance of that conference at the Cato Institute, we have links to the videos posted with this story. You can find it at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, it's that time once again to convene our annual roundtable to review some of the best tech available this holiday season. From Little Jones to Big Robots, we'll share our picks and ask our experts to help fill out your Santa list. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
In the halls of Hawaii State Senate, there appears to be some discontent as we approach this winter. It has to do with committee assignments. And with more on that story, we're joined by Chad Blair, the politics and opinion editor at Civil Beat. So, Chad, what's the root of this grumbling?
A nice nod to Shakespeare, by the way, Bill. But you know, grumbling is nothing new at the state legislature, both in the Senate and the House. There's always people that are out of power, who want to be in power, who object to whoever is in power. And in this case, four senators I contacted individually, and they told me their concerns that Senate President Ron Cochi didn't consult them when he was putting together the committees, and these committees are going to serve for the next 2 years. They say there's changes in how many people get to sit on how many committees. Any number of things having to do with the organization of the Senate. And why is this important? Well, committees is where it happens. That's where all the action is. That's where the bills are dealt with. If you're on the Ways and Means Committee, you're dealing with a state budget. You can have influence in trying to get money for capital improvement projects in your district. And so the folks that are not happy with that are saying Ron Cochi is to be blamed for this.
But we should mention also that they didn't want to have their names out there, right?
Correct. We granted them anonymity so they could, you know, preserve the relationships they have, such as they are, with their Senate colleagues. But Ron Cochi did speak on the record with me, as did Kai Kahele, one of the leaders at the Senate. And Cochi said, no, that's not true. You know, we don't always let people know, give them the chance to pick which committees, whether a freshman sits on Ways and Means their first year. That's not necessarily the case, although that has been the pattern. And he just more or less marked it up to discontent, used that word earlier. And as I said, these things happen every time, including when Donna Kim was Senate president before Cochi and before that Chancet Sui, back to Colleen Hanabusa. I'm probably missing one or two, Bobby Bunda somewhere in there. And so this happens, and it happens in the House too. And like the Senate, the House is controlled by certain factions. In this case, it's Scott Psyche as Speaker and Sylvia Luke running the Finance Committee, Della Albalotti. So this is not uncommon, but it's a big deal because ultimately senators are responsible to their constituents and they want to be seen as having influence at the legislature.
But it's also there's sort of part of this story is that there's we talk a lot of times, especially in government, about transparency and process. Mm, and yeah. There's not really a transparency that is assumed in this process, right?
That's correct. And what Cochi told me, the president said, you know, there may even be some changes further in terms of the lineup before the legislature convenes on January the 16th or starts its session. They're already at work. But no, the public is not privy to this. And in this case, the senators themselves were not consulted. I mean, it seems like a pretty basic thing. Which committee would you like to serve on, Senator? Well, I'd like to be on this, that, and the other thing. But as Kai Kahele pointed out, not everybody is going to get what they want. There's only so many coveted spots. Judiciary is another committee. Commerce, Consumer Protection, and Health as well. There's only so many seats to go around. Hmm. And it's not surprising that the party or the faction in power gets to make those decisions.
You know, in about a minute, Chad, you make the point in the column also that some committees with fewer members than right. in some sessions, the size of the committee an interesting factor as well in all of this.
Yeah, in most of the committees, I think it's 14 out of the 16 this year, just five members. Pretty easy to get a quorum to control votes as opposed to having, say, seven or nine members. And there's a lot more voices to try and corral. So that's been a change as well. Only Ways and Means and the Commerce Committee have larger than five members.
All right. Well, lots to look forward to when the season opens on January 16th. Look forward to that. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Bill.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, today featuring politics and opinion editor Chad Blair. You can read his full story, civilbeat.org.
For decades, Jesuit priests victimized Native kids in Alaska.
I thought I was bringing love into the life of other persons.
We confront one of the church leaders who moved those priests around.
I was always trying my best, and I know there were times I missed something.
Tracking down predator priests on the next Reveal.
This evening at 7.
The Pew Research Center does a lot of work around issues in society and does a lot of that work by taking surveys. You'll hear Pew quoted as a source on stories covering everything from politics to opinions about the media. This week, they're out with a pretty fascinating study titled 18 Striking Findings from 2018, and it's the focus of our regular segment, The Long View. Our contributing editor, Neil Milner, is here with a closer look, and Neil, this covers a lot of themes.
Yeah, it covers a lot of things, and they're all interesting. When I tried to figure out how to talk about them, there seems to be three kind of, let's call threads, topics that are important. because they resonate with what's going on now. Mm. One of which is the couple of facts about immigration and refugees that this should not be surprising, but the data is pretty stark, that we now have in this country a considerably smaller percentage, a considerably smaller number of illegal immigrants, unauthorized immigrants, than we've had for a while. It's dropped from about 12.5 to 10.5. And that's mainly due, and this started during the Obama administration and has continued, mainly due to the reduction in the influx of people from Mexico. By the same token, and this is not surprising, the percentage that's here, it's a greater percentage that have been here 10 years or more. So what you have is a trickle coming in, but a group of people who are still there. The other thing that's related to
that number, by the way, is interesting, peaked in 2007.
Yes,
it did. A little earlier than a lot of people think.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's what I mean. So that, you know, all of the Trump hype and all of the anti-Obama hype, this just reinforces what anybody who'd been paying attention knows, that it had stopped earlier because Obama did a lot of things under pressure from all kinds of people to tighten up. The second thing that's even more precipitous is the large reduction in the number of refugees that the U.S. took this year. It took only 33,000 refugees this year, which for the first time is lower than the rest of the European countries, the rest of the countries combined. This is slightly lower than it was in 2002, right after 2001, when then it went up. Mm. It went up, and then it dropped again. This probably is from the Trump things. This is a quarter of what it was in 1982. So if you think about the number of refugees we took last year, about equals to the population of, here's a city for you, Columbus, Mississippi, right? Mm. It's, which nobody has really heard of here. So that gives you an idea. That's one of the more salient things. It gives you a better notion of what the immigration refugee thing is like.
And that comparison and context, I love that about a lot of these factors that they point out in terms of putting that into some context with history as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. And when they don't, I mean, remember that this is not, these are just kind of factoids that they're putting out. Mm-hmm. It's an invitation to learn a lot more about them. But when you put them together, you learn a good deal. The one about media and social media, for example, the disparate findings there really tell you something. First of all, you wouldn't have had anything about social media that would show up as a striking fact, say, even 10 years ago, certainly 15 years ago. What you now have now is some very interesting things, one of which is that there's a high percentage, a significant percentage of people who find the news getting tired of the news, just being exhausted by the news. It's a percentage that cuts across political party. Republicans are more likely to feel that way, probably because they think that the news is biased against Trump. But overall, it's about 70% of the people who feel, in fact, as I feel, that you just get tired of this kind of stuff.
News fatigue.
News fatigue. Yeah. Then you look more closely at some of the things involving social media, and you begin to see some of the things that people have talked about. Two-thirds of the tweets about news, the links sent out about news, now come from bots, not from humans, mm-hmm. but from bots. You got things linking it. You have younger people more likely to turn off, to get rid of their Facebook app, at least temporarily, than others, reflecting, I think, a kind of ambivalence toward what's been happening with Facebook. You find that cyberbullying statistically shows up as a fairly significant problem. So you begin to see all the little threads that involve media and social media regarding the news, regarding the other things. And one other that's worth pointing out here is that it turns out that younger people are able to distinguish fact from opinion in the Pew surveys better than older people.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And they do the comparison, saying about a third of Americans 18 to 49 correctly identified five factual statements they were asked to categorize. Now, that's better than 20% of those who did at 50 and older. But still, that's less than a third.
It is less. No, it is less than a third. But I was surprised at how high it was, considering all of the stuff you're hearing about media literacy, and considering what people say about young folks not being identifying with politics. This was actually in some ways reassuring. It may be because I'm a political science professor, or I was, and it sets the bar pretty low. But again, what you see in these kinds of things is this kind of increasing salience of social media and some of the downsides of social media as far as the public is concerned, that younger folks are more likely to say, let's take a break from it. And older folks, maybe because they don't know how to delete apps, are more likely to say, are less likely to do it. Then there's one other one that's worth mentioning, and that is the sexual harassment one. One of the facts is that about 59%, I think it is, of women claim that during their lifetime they've been sexually harassed. And what's interesting about this, because you can have different explanations, is that the more education you had, the more likely this would be. It differs by race, whites more likely. Now, there are two ways to think about that, one of which is that the events, it actually reflects the number of events. But remember, these events are defined by people's sensitivity toward them. That is, what some person may see as sexual harassment, another may not. That may have something to do with it. But the fact, I guess the overwhelming important factor there is that the significant percentage of women who say that they're sexually harassed. The other thing is the precipitous drop among Catholics in approval of the Pope's handling the sexual harassment, the sexual abuse issue. The Pope really had not surprisingly, had a very strong sentiment of support when he started. That's dropped a great deal over time, and it doesn't make any difference how devout a Catholic you are. It doesn't vary, even people who attend Mass regularly. I mention that specifically in light of the fact that it was just on the news that a Monsignor in Los Angeles, that's a high-level Catholic prelate, resigned after accusations of sexual abuse.
You know, 2 points. One, the 6 in 10 women in the U.S. saying that they had been sexually harassed at some point in their lives. I thought that number was low. Actually.
Oh, you did? Yes. Yeah, you've seen different. Whenever you ask people about those things, you know, you offer a definition about what you mean by sexual abuse.
Harassment.
This is the same with crime victimization. Over time, you initially have to pay attention to how they're defining it. But yeah, you're right. I have seen surveys where it's higher.
The other interesting point, just in living in Hawaii as well, most Americans, 59%, say climate change is affecting their local community, and especially, again, that number goes higher for those who, live near a coast.
Yeah, they measure it by how close you live. If you're 25 miles, I think, isn't that the number, 25 miles or less, you're considerably more likely to worry about the effect of climate change. That pretty much takes care of anybody who lives in Hawaii. you would assume it's the same. They don't even look there at polarization, which makes a difference on climate change. Republicans are less likely to see climate change as a problem, but maybe there are no atheists in foxholes. Maybe
exactly.
Everybody agrees when you're that close to the water.
None by the coastline, exactly. Pew Research Center, interesting findings there. Neil Milner. Thanks, Neil.
You're welcome.
Neil Milner, retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Willow. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
In In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we took a look at the life and music of Robert Alexander Anderson. Born in Honolulu, he was a composer who came up with several popular hapa-haole tunes like Hawali Hula and Lovely Hula Hands. Though he never received any formal training in music, didn't speak Hawaiian, his composition is popular in the islands and also around the world. He was also a veteran of the First World War who became known for executing a successful escape after being taken as a prisoner of war by the Germans. That served as part of an inspiration for the 1938 film The Dawn Patrol. Many reasons why his legacy lives on, but it's his famous 1949 Christmas song that he's most remembered for. We asked you to name that tune. It is, as many of you realized, Mele Kalikimaka. Today's quiz, we had a winner, Jesse Allen of Honolulu, a very popular quiz, by the way. The phone bank just lit up, so say our producers. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Mele Kalikimaka is a thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day. That's the island greeting that we send to you from the land where palm trees sway. Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright, the sun to shine by day and all the stars at night.
And you knew that Bing Crosby was going to be joining us this morning on the conversation when you heard the quiz.
You could bust in on that, right?
Exactly. But hey, if your schedule is going to be slowing down over the next couple of weeks or so, you might take the opportunity to do a little local art exploring. To do that, you really should have a good guide. And so we got you one of the best, our own arts and culture reporter, Noe Tanigawa, here with some thoughts.
Bill, I wish I could have taken you with me on this terrific tour I did of some terrific galleries in town that have been opening, believe it or not. As we all, you know, we can't wait around for things to happen in art. We have to participate and help make them happen. As shoppers, yeah, it helps. So I headed over to Kailua for my first stop on Ku'ule Road. You know, there are a couple of blocks there on the end of Ku'ule Road, which is the main drag through there, nearer the edge of town. I parked, and then I was walking past Kailua General Store, which was so fun. Have you ever stopped there?
Yes, I have, actually.
Neat, isn't it?
It's a fun place to wander around, yeah.
Men's shaving supplies, full-on real fishing gear, and a coconut straw. That's what I saw this time. It's some kind of crazy tool that lets you drink out of the next green coconut you see.
Wow.
And then, next door, a little further on, the new Kailua Gallery. It's been there since April 2018. That's this year. Mm. Ruth Sorensen, fine painter, is now a gallery owner.
Mm-hmm. I don't have much experience, but I have a huge amount of community support and excitement around the show and everything that we're doing. We have 34 artists in this show. They range from 17 years old to 85. You know, all ranges of experience and education. So it was a real success.
How did you choose the participants?
You know, I really was just looking for artists who had demonstrated real skill and thought in their work. You know, we are so inundated by artwork that is propelled by commercialism, which is fueled by tourism. And I just wanted to show other ways of making art and ways of presenting it.
You really feel that as soon as you walk into the gallery.
Nice.
Affordable pieces by Rimba Sus, Hadley Nunez, Brenda Caballan's landscapes are super hitting the spot these days. And she's got a nice corner there in the gallery. Small sculptures, too. And they're going to be having classes and even a figure drawing studio there in that gallery. So I'm really excited about the next year coming up for Kailua Gallery. Now, you know what? After that, I just headed right around Hee'ea side all the way over to past Sunset Pipeline the whole night to Hale'iwa.
Oh, nice.
Great stores over there, right? And I've been meaning to get out to Polu Gallery, which focuses on surf art. Owner Jun Yoshimura grew up in Europe and then in Japan. His first love was music, and then he decided to focus on surfing and art. He opened up the Green Room Gallery in Waikiki. That was there for several years. Yeah. And about 3 years ago, he decided to focus on surf art and move his gallery to Hale'iwa.
I like this location and also the customers. You know, good mix. Tourists and also local people.
Surf art is an international thing?
Yeah, mainly California and Hawaii, Japan, you know.
Oh, and what are the, how would you describe it?
Most of artists is surfer, so they have a more, you know, free spirit and more mellow.
You know, June says surf art is kind of simpler. And it's got a nice little kind of a manga feel there out of his gallery. He says it's art that can actually fit in your house without taking it over, nice. Which is kind of a nice thing, you know. Mm. It's fun art. It's happy. On January 5th, he's opening a show with Jonas Klassen of Surfing Animals fame. And right now he's got an amazing show there of work, photographs by Wayne Levin. They're marvelous, and it's really worth a drive out.
And it brings in a little spirit into the house as well.
Oh, it does so much. You know, when you look at there, you know, it's like having reggae on all of a sudden in the background. You know, then back in town, look, Bill, you know, I did a whole lot of taking care of business at the shop in Kaimuki. Have you stopped there yet?
I have not. I have been by but not through.
Yeah. A lot of people feel that way. Park across the street, a lot of parking in the lot there. Mm. Head on over. It is terrific. It's a gallery of books, and you get excited just walking in. Namea at Ward Center, they moved, you know, and they're at Ward Center. Now, they're a must. Their Ni'ihau shell jewelry is getting more beautiful all the time, and they're working in some contemporary designs that are really great. There's also the Namea Kaliki Maka shop, too, with small, thoughtful gifts, and they've always got classes and workshops going on there as well. Things you can make are happening.
That's nice, that experiential side.
It is. Well. And that's what Namea is always about. They're looking for places that they animate with activities. Mm. They get people into their place making things. And, you know, that little bit of community is what another gallery has managed to maintain over a couple of decades. And that is Nohea Gallery. A lot of people wondered what happened to them when Ward Warehouse closed down. Well, Nohea, they opened up a happy shop in the Hyatt Regency, thank you. And they have just opened a gorgeous space in Kahala Mall. I talked with Lori Barron, co-founder, yesterday. She was a co-founder with her mom, Gail, and we met at their new home in Kahala.
We're at a really interesting transitional time. So the old guard, their work is always evolving and changing, as artists do, right? We just lost Ron Kent actually yesterday as one example of a major transition. But the younger folks are coming up and new people are learning. And an example, the Honolulu Woodturners are wonderful, wonderful collaborative group that encourages new woodturners and teaches. That's something that's very special, I think, about Hawaii, different from many art communities, and that they are interested in helping each other. But every artist has got their story and their sort of dreams, their aspirations, and their history. And weaving it together is the project, and it's a delight. You know, it's really an honor, and we're very grateful to have a place in people's lives and be able to connect.
Lori, help these artists who are listening right now. What do people want to buy?
They want to buy things that are beautiful, things that are useful, things that are that share, you know, a feeling. I don't know how to express that. Something that gives joy, you know, to the soul, to the heart. And that's a tall order. That's what people want.
But, you know, believe it or not, a lot of Hawaii artists are up to that. So just get out there and look for it. Now, look, this is a season we all know about, and last night I went to Studio 909 for pianist Rich Crandall's annual Christmas party. It's a jazz Christmas party with bassist Bruce Hamada and drummer Stacy Tanganon. Now, Hamada's a crusty jazzer. He said he's given up on the Christmas spirit long ago, but you know, Bruce, we all keep it together. We do. And we'd like to thank you for managing to do it a little for us there at that beautiful gathering last night.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Noe. HPR's Noe Tanigawa. You know her. You can find her reports online at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we have an unusual look at Waikiki. We'll hear about the history of its ecology before the Alawai Canal, with some voices brought to us by way of the University of Hawaii's Center for Oral History. We'll also have some contemporary voices, Andrew Rossiter of the Waikiki Aquarium, Dolan Eversole of the University of Hawaii's Sea Grant Program. We'd also like to hear your thoughts about Waikiki's future. You can call in during the program at 808-941-3869. Give us a call anytime with a thought or story idea, 808-792-8217. Find us on Facebook. Show all our past ones on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman, back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.